Chapter 5. So they will have told you doubtless already how I told that Jones to take that mule, which was not his, around to the barn, and harness it to our buggy while I put on my hat and shawl and locked the house. That was all I needed to do, since they will have told you doubtless that I would have had no need for either trunk or bag, since what clothing I possessed, now that the garments which I had been fortunate enough to inherit from my aunt's kindness or haste or oversight, were long since worn out, consisted of the ones which Ellen had remembered from time to time to give me, and now Ellen these 2 years dead. That I had only to lock the house and take my place in the buggy and traverse those 12 miles which I had not done since Ellen died. Beside that brute who until Ellen died was not even permitted to approach the house from the front. That brute progenitor of brutes whose granddaughter was to supplant me, if not in my sister's house, at least in my sister's bed, to which, so they will tell you, I aspired. That brute who, brute instrument of that justice which presides over human events, which, incept in the individual, runs smooth, less claw than velvet, but which by man or woman flouted drives on like fiery steel and overrides both weakly just and unjust strong, both vanquisher and innocent victimized, ruthless for appointed right and truth. Brute, who was not only to preside upon the various shapes and avatars of Thomas Sutpen's devil's fate, but was to provide at the last the female flesh in which his name and lineage should be sepulchred. That brute who appeared to believe that he had served and performed his appointed end by yelling of blood and pistols in the street before my house. Who seemed to believe that what further information he might have given me was too scant or too bland and free of moment to warrant the discarding of his tobacco cud, because during the entire subsequent 12 miles he could not even tell me what had happened. And how I traversed those same 12 miles once more after the 2 years since Ellen died, or was it the 4 years since Henry vanished, or was it the 19 years since I saw light and breathed? Knowing nothing, able to learn nothing save this, a shot heard, faint and far away, and even direction and source indeterminate, by two young women alone in a rotting house where no man's footstep had sounded in 2 years. A shot, then an interval of aghast surmise above the cloth and needles which engaged them. Then feet, in the hall and then on the stairs, running, hurrying, the feet of a man. And Judith, with just time to snatch up the unfinished dress and hold it before her as the door burst open upon her brother, the wild murderer whom she had not seen in 4 years and whom she believed to be, if he was, still lived and breathed at all, 1,000 miles away. And then the two accursed children on whom the first blow of their devil's heritage had but that moment fallen, looking at one another across the upraised and unfinished wedding dress. 12 miles toward that I rode, beside an animal who could stand in the street before my house and bellow placidly to the populous and listening solitude that my nephew had just murdered his sister's fiancé, yet who could not permit himself to force the mule which drew us beyond a walk, because it warn't none of mine nor his neither, and besides it ain't had a decent bait of victuals since the corn give out in February. Who, turning into the actual gate at last, must stop the mule, and pointin' with the whip and spittin' first, say, "It was right yonder." "What was right there, fool?" I cried, and he, "It was," until I took the whip from him into my own hand and struck the mule. But they cannot tell you how I went on up the drive, past Ellen's ruined and weed-choked flower beds, and reached the house, the shell, the, so I thought, cocoon casket marriage bed of youth and grief, and found that I had come, not too late as I had thought, but come too soon. Rotting portico and scaling walls, it stood, not ravaged, not invaded, marked by no bullet nor soldier's iron heel, but rather as though reserved for something more. Some desolation more profound than ruin, as if it had stood in iron juxtaposition to iron flame, to a holocaust which had found itself less fierce and less implacable, not hurled but rather fallen back before the impervious and indomitable skeleton which the flames durst not, at the instant's final crisis, assail. There was even one step, one plank rotted free and tilting beneath the foot, or would have if I had not touched it light and fast, as I ran up and into the hallway whose carpet had long since gone with the bed and table linen for lint, and saw the sutpan face. And even as I cried, "Henry, Henry, what have you done? What has that fool been trying to tell me?" realized that I had come not too late as I had thought, but come too soon. Because it was not Henry's face. It was Sutpan face enough, but not his. Sutpan coffee-colored face enough there in the dim light, barring the stairs. And I, running out of the bright afternoon into the thunderous silence of that brooding house where I could see nothing at first. Then gradually the face, the Sutpan face, not approaching, not swimming up out of the gloom, but already there, rock-like and firm and antedating time and house and doom and all. Waiting there. Oh, yes, he chose well. He bettered choosing who created in his own image the cold Cerberus of his private hell. The face without sex or age, because it had never possessed either. The same sphinx face which she had been born with, which had looked down from the loft that night beside Judith's, and which she still wears now at 74. Looking at me with no change, no alteration in it at all, as though it had known to the second when I was to enter, had waited there during that entire 12 miles behind that walking mule, and watched me draw nearer and nearer, and enter the door at last, as it had known, ah, perhaps decreed, since there is that justice whose Moloch's palate paunch makes no distinction between gristle bone and tender flesh, that I should. The face stopping me dead, not my body, it still advanced, ran on. But I myself, that deep existence which we lead, to which the movement of limbs is but a clumsy and belated accompaniment like so many unnecessary instruments played crudely and amateurishly out of time to the tune itself. In that barren hall with its naked stair, that carpet gone too, rising into the dim upper hallway, where an echo spoke which was not mine but rather that of the lost, irrevocable might-have-been which haunts all houses. All enclosed walls erected by human hands, not for shelter, not for warmth, but to hide from the world's curious looking and seeing the dark turnings which the ancient young delusions of pride and hope and ambition, aye, and love too, take. "Judith," I said, "Judith." There was no answer. I had expected none. Possibly even then I did not expect Judith to answer. Just as a child, before the full instant of comprehended terror, calls on the parent whom it actually knows, this before the terror destroys all judgment whatever, is not even there to hear it. I was crying not to someone, something, but trying to cry, through something, through that force, that furious yet absolutely rock-like and immobile antagonism which had stopped me. That presence, that familiar coffee-colored face, that body, the bare coffee-colored feet motionless on the bare floor, the curve of the stair rising just beyond her. No larger than my own, which, without moving, with no alteration of visual displacement whatever, she did not even remove her gaze from mine for the reason that she was not looking at me but through me, apparently still musing upon the open door's serene rectangle which I had broken, seemed to elongate and project upward something, not soul, not spirit, but something rather of a profoundly attentive and distracted listening to or for something, which I myself could not hear and was not intended to hear. A brooding awareness and acceptance of the inexplicable unseen inherited from an older and a purer race than mine, which created, postulated, and shaped in the empty air between us that which I believed I had come to find, nay, which I must find, else breathing and standing there I would have denied that I was ever born. That bedroom long closed and musty, that sheetless bed, that nuptial couch of love and grief, with the pale and bloody corpse in its patched and weathered grey, crimson in the bare mattress, the bowed and unwived widow kneeling beside it, and I, my body, not stopping yet, yes, it needed the hand, the touch for that, ah, self-mesmered fool who still believed that what must be would be, could not but be. else I must deny sanity as well as breath. Running, hurling myself into that inscrutable coffee-colored face, that cold, implacable, mindless, no, not mindless, anything but mindless, his own clairvoyant will tempered to amoral evils undeviating absolute by the black will and blood with which he had crossed it, replica of his own, which he had created and decreed to preside upon his absence, as you might watch a wild, distracted, night-bound bird flutter into the brazen and fatal lamp. "Wait," she said, "don't you go up there." Still I did not stop. It would require the hand. And I still running on, accomplishing those last few feet across which we seemed to glare at one another, not as two faces, but as the two abstract contradictions which we actually were. Neither of our voices raised, as though we spoke to one another free of the limitations and restrictions of speech and hearing. "What?" I said. "Don't you go up there, Rosa." That was how she said it. That quiet, that still. And again it was as though it had not been she who spoke, but the house itself that said the words. The house which he had built, which some suppuration of himself had created about him as the sweat of his body might have created, produced, some, even if invisible, cocoon-like and complementary shell in which Ellen had had to live and die a stranger, in which Henry and Judith would have to be victims and prisoners or die. Because it was not the name, the word, the fact that she had called me Rosa. As children she had called me that, just as she had called them Henry and Judith. I knew that even now she still called Judith, and Henry too when she spoke of him, by her given name. And she might very naturally have called me Rosa still, since to everyone else whom I knew I was still a child. But it was not that. That was not what she meant at all. In fact, during that instant while we stood face to face, that instant before my still-advancing body should brush past her and reach the stair, she did me more grace and respect than anyone else I knew. I knew that from the instant I had entered that door, to her of all who knew me I was no child. "Rosa," I cried, "to me, to my face?" Then she touched me, and then I did stop dead. Possibly even then my body did not stop, since I seemed to be aware of it thrusting blindly still against the solid yet imponderable weight, she not owner, instrument, I still say that, of that will to bar me from the stairs. Possibly the sound of the other voice, the single word spoken from the stairhead above us, had already broken and parted us before it, my body, had even paused. I do not know. I know only that my entire being seemed to run at blind full tilt into something monstrous and immobile, with a shock and impact too soon and too quick to be mere amazement and outrage at that black, arresting, and untimorous hand on my white woman's flesh. Because there is something in the touch of flesh with flesh which abrogates, cuts sharp and straight across the devious, intricate channels of decorous ordering, which enemies as well as lovers know because it makes them both. Touch and touch of that which is the citadel of the central I am's private own. Not spirit, soul. The licorice and ungirdled mind is anyone's to take in any darkened hallway of this earthly tenement. But let flesh touch with flesh, and watch the fall of all the eggshell shibboleth of caste and color too. Yes, I stopped dead. No woman's hand, no negro's hand, but bitted bridle-curb to check and guide the furious and unbending will. I cry not to her, to it, speaking to it through the negro, the woman, only because of the shock which was not yet outrage, because it would be terror soon, expecting and receiving no answer, because we both knew it was not to her I spoke. "Take your hand off me, nigger." I got none. We just stood there. I motionless in the attitude and action of running, she rigid in that furious immobility, the two of us joined by that hand and arm which held us, like a fierce, rigid umbilical cord, twin-sistered to the fell darkness which had produced her. As a child I had more than once watched her and Judith and even Henry scuffling in the rough games which they, possibly all children, I do not know, played, And, so I have heard, she and Judith even slept together, in the same room, but with Judith in the bed and she on a pallet on the floor, ostensibly. But I have heard how on more than one occasion Ellen has found them both on the pallet, and once in the bed together. But not I. Even as a child I would not even play with the same objects which she and Judith played with. As though that warped and spartan solitude which I called my childhood, which had taught me, and little else, to listen before I could comprehend and to understand before I even heard, had also taught me not only to instinctively fear her and what she was, but to shun the very objects which she had touched. We stood there so. And then suddenly it was not outrage that I waited for, out of which I had instinctively cried. It was not terror. It was some cumulative overreach of despair itself. I remember how, as we stood there joined by that volitionless, yes, it too sentient victim just as she and I were, hand, I cried, perhaps not aloud, not with words and not to Judith, mind, perhaps I knew already on the instant I entered the house and saw that face which was at once both more and less than Sutphen, perhaps I knew even then what I could not, would not, must not believe. I cried, and you too, sister, sister? What did I expect? Ah, self-mesmered fool, come 12 miles expectin' what? Henry, perhaps, to emerge from some door which knew his touch, his hand on the knob, the weight of his foot on a sill which knew that weight. And so to find standin' in the hall a small, plain, frightened creature whom neither man nor woman had ever looked at twice, whom he had not seen himself in 4 years, and seldom enough before that, but whom he would recognize if only because of the worn brown silk which had once become his mother, and because the creature stood there calling him by his given name. Henry to emerge and say, "Why, it's Rosa, Aunt Rosa, wake up, Aunt Rosa, wake up!" Ah, the dreamer! Clinging yet to the dream as the patient clings to the last thin, unbearable, ecstatic instant of agony, in order to sharpen the savor of the pain's surcease. Waken into the reality, the more than reality, not to the unchanged and unaltered old time, but into a time altered to fit the dream, which, conjunctive with the dreamer, becomes immolated and apotheosized. Mother and Judith are in the nursery with the children, and Father and Charles are walking in the garden. Wake up, Aunt Rosa, wake up! Or not expect, perhaps, not even hope, not even dream, since dreams don't come in pairs. And had I not come 12 miles, drawn not by mortal mule, but by some chimera foal of nightmare's very self? Ah, wake up, Rosa, wake up! Not from what was, what used to be, but from what had not, could not have ever been. Wake, Rosa, not to what should, what might have been, but to what cannot, what must not be. Wake, Rosa, from the hopin', who did believe there is a seemliness to bereavement even though grief be absent. Believe there would be need for you to save, not love, perhaps, not happiness nor peace, but what was left behind by widowin', and found that there was nothing there to save. Who hoped to save her as you promised Ellen, not Charles Bond, not Henry, not either one of these from him or even from one another. And now too late, who would have been too late if you had come there from the womb or had been there already at the full, strong, capable mortal peak when she was born, who came 12 miles and 19 years to save what did not need the saving, and lost instead yourself. I do not know, except that I did not find it. I found only that dream state in which you run without moving from a terror in which you cannot believe, toward a safety in which you have no faith, held so not by the shifting and foundationless quicksand of nightmare, but by a face which was its soul's own inquisitor, a hand which was the agent of its own crucifixion, until the voice parted us, broke the spell. It said one word, Clytie, like that, that cold, that still. Not Judith, but the house itself speaking again, though it was Judith's voice. Oh, I knew it well, who had believed in Grievan's seemliness. I knew it as well as she, Clytie, knew it. She did not move, it was only the hand gone before I realized that it had been removed. I do not know if she removed it or if I ran out from beneath its touch, but it was gone. And this, too, they cannot tell you, how I ran, fled up the stairs, and found no grieving widowed bride but Judith, standing before the closed door to that chamber, in the gingham dress which she had worn each time I had seen her since Ellen died, holding something in one hanging hand. And if there had been grief or anguish, she had put them too away, complete or not complete, I do not know, along with that unfinished wedding dress. "Yes, Rosa," she said, like that again. And I stopped in running's mid-stride again, though my body, blind, unsentient barrow of diluted clay and breath, still advanced. And how I saw that what she held in that lax and negligent hand was the photograph, the picture of herself in its metal case which she had given him, held casual and forgotten against her flank as any interrupted pastime book. That's what I found. Perhaps it's what I expected, knew, even at 19 knew, I would say if it were not for my 19, my own particular kind of 19 years, that I should find. Perhaps I couldn't even have wanted more than that, couldn't have accepted less, who even at 19 must have known that living is one constant and perpetual instant when the heiress veil before what is to be hangs docile and even glad to the lightest naked thrust if we had dared, were brave enough, not wise enough, no wisdom needed here, to make the rending gash. Or perhaps it is no lack of courage either, not cowardice which will not face that sickness somewhere at the prime foundation of this factual scheme from which the prisoner soul, miasmal distillant, roils ever upward, sunward, tugs its tenuous prisoner arteries and veins, and prisoning in its turn that spark, that dream which, as the globy and complete instant of its freedom mirrors and repeats, creates, reduces to a fragile evanescent iridescent sphere, all of space and time and massy earth, relics the seething and anonymous miasmal mass which in all the years of time has taught itself no boon of death, but only how to recreate, renew, and dies, is gone, vanished, nothing. But is that true wisdom which can comprehend that there is a might have been which is more true than truth, from which the dreamer, wakened, says not, did I but dream, but rather says, indites high heaven's very self with, why did I wake, since waken I shall never sleep again? Once there was... Do you mark how the wisteria, sun impacted on this wall here, distills and penetrates this room as though, light unimpeded, by secret and attritive progress from mote to mote of obscurity's myriad components? That is the substance of remembering, sense, sight, smell, the muscles with which we see and hear and feel, not mind, not thought. There is no such thing as memory. The brain recalls just what the muscles grope for, no more, no less, and its resultant sum is usually incorrect and false and worthy only of the name of dream. See how the sleepin' outflung hand, touching the bedside candle, remembers pain, springs back and free while mind and brain sleep on, and only make of this adjacent heat some trashy myth of reality's escape. Or that same sleepin' hand, in sensuous marriage with some dulcet surface, is transformed by that same sleepin' brain and mind into that same figment stuff warped out of all experience. Ah, grief goes, fades, we know that, but ask the tear ducts if they have forgotten how to weep. Once there was, they cannot have told you this either, a summer of wisteria. It was a pervading everywhere of wisteria. I was 14 then. As though of all springs yet to capitulate, condensed into one spring, one summer. The spring and summertime, which is every female's who breathed above dust, beholden of all betrayed springs, held over from all irrevocable time, repercussed, bloomed again. It was a vintage year of wisteria, vintage year being that sweet conjunction of root bloom and urge and hour and weather. And I was 14, I will not insist on bloom at whom no man had yet to look, nor would ever twice, as not as child, but less than even child, as not more child than woman, but even as less than any female flesh. Nor do I say leaf, warped, bitter, pale, and crimped, half-fledgling, intimidate of any claim to green which might have drawn to it the tender mayfly childhood sweetheart games, or given pause to the male predaceous wasps and bees of later lust. But root and urge I do insist and claim, for had I not erred too from all the unsistered eaves since the snake? Yes, urge I do, warped chrysalis of what blind perfect seed. For who shall say what gnarled forgotten root might not bloom yet with some globed concentrate, more globed and concentrate and heady perfect, because the neglected root was planted warped, and lay not dead, but merely slept forgot? That was the miscast summer of my barren youth, which, for that short time, that short brief unreturning springtime of the female heart, I lived out not as a woman, a girl, but rather as the man which I perhaps should have been. I was 14 then, 14 in years, if they could have been called years, while in that unpaced corridor which I called childhood, which was not living but rather some projection of the lightless womb itself. I, gestate and complete, not aged, just overdue because of some caesarean lack, some cold head-nuzzling forceps of the savage time which should have torn me free, I waited not for light but for that doom which we call female victory, which is endure, and then endure, without rhyme or reason or hope of reward, and then endure. I like that blind subterranean fish, that insulated spark whose origin the fish no longer remembers, which pulses and beats at its crepuscular and lethargic tenement with the old unsleeping itch which has no words to speak with other than this was called light. That smell, that touch, that other something which has bequeathed not even name for sound of bee or bird or flower scent or light or sun or love. Yes, not even growing and developing, beloved by and loving light, but equipped only with that cunning, that inverted canker growth of solitude which substitutes the omnivorous and unrational hearing sense for all the others. So that instead of accomplishing the processional and measured milestones of the normal childhood's time, I lurked, unapprehended, as though, shod with the very damp and velvet silence of the womb, I displaced no air, gave off no betraying sound, from one closed, forbidden door to the next, and so acquired all I knew of that light and space in which people moved and breathed, as I, that same child, might have gained conception of the sun from seeing it through a piece of smoky glass. 14, 4 years younger than Judith, 4 years later than Judith's moment, which only virgins know. When the entire delicate spirit's bent is one anonymous climaxless epicene and unravished nuptial. Not that widowed and nightly violation by the inescapable and scornful dead, which is the meed of 20 and 30 and 40. But a world filled with living marriage, like the light and air which she breathes. But it was no summer of a virgin's itch and discontent, no summer's caesarean lack which should have torn me, dead flesh or even embryo, from the living, or else by friction's ravishing of the male furrowed meat, also weaponed and panoplied as a man instead of hollow woman. It was the summer after that first Christmas that Henry brought him home, the summer following the 2 days of that June vacation which he spent at Sutpen's Hundred, before he rode on to the river to take the steamboat home, that summer after my aunt left and Papa had to go away on business, and I was sent out to Ellen. Possibly my father chose Ellen as a refuge for me, because at that time Thomas Sutpen was also absent, to stay so that she could take care of me, who had been born too late, born into some curious disjoint of my father's life and left on his, now twice widowed hands. I competent enough to reach a kitchen shelf, count spoons and hem a sheet and measure milk into a churn, yet good for nothing else, yet still too valuable to be left alone. I had never seen him. I never saw him. I never even saw him dead. I heard a name. I saw a photograph. I helped to make a grave, and that was all. Though he had been in my house once, that first New Year's Day when Henry brought him from nephew duty to speak to me on their way back to school and I was not at home. Until then I had not even heard his name, did not know that he existed. Yet on the day when I went out there to stay that summer, it was as though that casual pause at my door had left some seed, some minute virulence in this cellar earth of mine, quick not for love, perhaps. I did not love him, how could I? I had never even heard his voice, had only Ellen's word for it that there was such a person. And quick not for the spying, which you will doubtless call it, which during the past 6 months between that New Year's and that June gave substance to that shadow with a name emerging from Ellen's vain and garrulous folly, that shape without even a face yet because I had not even seen the photograph then, reflected in the secret and bemused gaze of a young girl. Because I, who had learned nothing of love, not even parents' love, that fond, dear, constant violation of privacy, that stultification of the burgeoning and incorrigible eye which is the meed and due of all mammalian meat, became not mistress, not beloved, but more than even love. I became all polymath love's androgynous advocate. There must have been some seed he left, to cause a child's vacant fairy tale to come alive in that garden, because I was not spying when I would follow her. I was not spying, though you will say I was. And even if it was spying, it was not jealousy, because I did not love him. How could I have when I had never seen him? And even if I did, not as woman love, as Judith loved him, or as we thought she did. If it was love, and I still say how could it be? It was the way that mothers love when, punishing the child, she strikes not it, but through it strikes the neighbor boy whom it has just whipped or been whipped by, caresses not the rewarded child, but rather the nameless man or woman who gave the palm-sweated penny, but not as women love. Because I asked nothing of him, you see. And more than that, I gave him nothing which is the sum of lovin'. Why, I didn't even miss him. I don't know even now if I was ever aware that I had seen nothing of his face but that photograph, that shadow, that picture in the young girl's bedroom, a picture casual and framed upon a littered dressing table, yet bowered and dressed, or so I thought, with all the maiden and invisible lily roses, because even before I saw the photograph I could have recognized, nay, described the very face, but I never saw it. I do not even know of my own knowledge that Ellen ever saw it, that Judith ever loved it, that Henry slew it. So who will dispute me when I say, why did I not invent, create it? And I know this. If I were God, I would invent out of this seething turmoil we call progress something, a machine perhaps, which would adorn the barren mirror altars of every plain girl who breathes with such as this, which is so little since we want so little, this pictured face. It would not even need a skull behind it, almost anonymous. It would only need vague inference of some walk in flesh and blood desired by someone else, even if only in some shadow realm of make-believe. A picture seen by stealth, by creepin'. My childhood taught me that instead of love, and it stood me in good stead. In fact, if it had taught me love, love could not have stood me so. Into the deserted midday room to look at it. Not to dream, since I dwelt in the dream, but to renew, rehearse, the part as the faulty though eager amateur might steal wingward in some interim of the visible scene to hear the prompter's momentary voice. And if jealousy, not man's jealousy, the jealousy of the lover, not even the lover's self who spies from love, who spies to watch, taste, touch that maiden reverie of solitude which is the first thinning of that veil we call virginity. Not to spring out, force that shame which is such a part of love's declaring, but to gloat upon the rich instantaneous bosom already rosy with the flushy sleep. Though shame itself does not yet need to wake. No, it was not that. I was not spying. Who would walk those raked and sanded garden paths and think, this print was his, save for this obliterating rake, that even despite the rake it is still there, and hers beside it in that slow and mutual rhythm wherein the heart, the mind, does not need to watch the docile, aye, the willin' feet. Would think, What suspiration of the twinning souls have the murmurous myriad ears of this secluded vine or shrub listened to? What vow, what promise, what rapt Biden fire has the lilac rain of this wisteria, this heavy rose's dissolution, crowned? But best of all, better far than this, the actual living and the dreamy flesh itself. Oh no, I was not spying while I dreamed in the lurking harborage of my own shrub or vine, as I believed she dreamed upon the nooky seat which held invisible imprint of his absent thighs, just as the obliterating sand, the million finger nerves of frond and leaf, the very sun and moony constellations which had looked down at him, the circumambient air, held somewhere yet his foot, his passing shape, his face, his speaking voice, his name. Charles Bonn, Charles Good, Charles husband soon to be. No, not spying. Not even hiding, who was child enough not to need to hide, whose presence would have been no violation even though he sat with her, yet woman enough to have gone to her entitled to be received, perhaps with pleasure, gratitude, into that maiden shameless confidence where young girls talk of love. Yes, child enough to go to her and say, "Let me sleep with you." Woman enough to say, "Let us lie in bed together while you tell me what love is." Yet who did not do it because I should have had to say, "Don't talk to me of love, but let me tell you, who know already more of love than you will ever know or need." Then my father returned and came for me and took me home, and I became again that nondescript, too long a child, yet too short a woman, in the fitless garments which my aunt had left behind, keeping a fitless house, who was not spying, hiding, but waiting, watching, for no reward, no thanks, who did not love him in the sense we mean it, because there is no love of that sort without hope, who, if it were love, loved with that sort beyond the compass of glib books, that love which gives up what it never had, that penny's modicum which is the donor's all, yet whose infinitesimal weight adds nothing to the substance of the loved. And yet I gave it, and not to him, to her. It was as though I said to her, "Here, take this too. You cannot love him as he should be loved, and though he will no more feel this given's weight than he would ever know its lack, yet there may come some moment in your married lives when he will find this atom's particle as you might find a cramped, small, pallid, hidden shoot in a familiar flower bed, and pause and say, 'Where did this come from?' You need only answer, 'I don't know.' And then I went back home and stayed 5 years, heard an echoed shot, ran up a nightmare flight of steps, and found, why, a woman, standing calmly in a gingham dress before a closed door which she would not allow me to enter. A woman more strange to me than any grief for being so less its partner. A woman saying, 'Yes, Rosa,' calmly into the mid-stride of my running which, I know it now, had begun 5 years ago, since he had been in my house too and had left no more trace than he had left in Ellen's, where he had been but a shape, a shadow, not of a man, a being, but of some esoteric piece of furniture, vase or chair or desk, which Ellen wanted, as though his very impression or lack of it on cold field or sutton walls held portentous prophecy of what was to be. Yes, running out of that first year, that year before the war, during which Ellen talked to me of trousseau, and it my trousseau, of all the dreamy panoply of surrender which was my surrender, which had so little to surrender that it was all I had, because there is that might have been which is the single rock we cling to above the maelstrom of unbearable reality. The 4 years while I believed she waited as I waited, while the stable world which we had been taught to know dissolved in fire and smoke, until peace and security were gone, and pride and hope, and there was left only maimed honor's veterans and love. Yes, there should, there must be love and faith. These left with us by fathers, husbands, sweethearts, brothers, who carried the pride and the hope of peace in honor's vanguard as they did the flags. There must be these, else what do men fight for? What else worth dying for? Yes, dying not for honor's empty sake, nor pride, nor even peace, but for that love and faith they left behind. Because he was to die, I know that, knew that, as both pride and peace were. Else how to prove love's immortality? but not love, not faith itself, themselves. Love without hope, perhaps, faith with little to be proud with. But love and faith at least above the murdering and the folly, to salvage at least from the humbled indicted dust something away of the old lost enchantment of the heart. Yes, found her standing before that closed door which I was not to enter, and which she herself did not enter again to my knowledge until Jones and the other man carried the coffin up the stairs, with the photograph hanging at her side and her face absolutely calm, looking at me for a moment and just raising her voice enough to be heard in the hall below. "Clytie, Miss Rosa will be here for dinner. You had better get out some more meal." Then, "Shall we go downstairs? I will have to speak to Mr. Jones about some planks and nails." That was all, or rather not all, since there is no all, no finish. It not the blow we suffer from, but the tedious repercussive anticlimax of it, the rubbishy aftermath to clear away from off the very threshold of despair.
This book is continued on Disc 5.
That was all, or rather not all, since there is no all, no finish. It not the blow we suffer from, but the tedious repercussive anticlimax of it, the rubbishy aftermath to clear away from off the very threshold of despair. You see, I never saw him. I never even saw him dead. I heard an echo, but not the shot. I saw a closed door, but did not enter it. I remember how that afternoon when we carried the coffin from the house, Jones and another white man which he produced, exhumed from somewhere, made it of boards torn from the carriage house. I remember how while we ate the food which Judith, yes, Judith, the same face calm, cold, and tranquil above the stove, had cooked, ate it in the very room which he lay over, we could hear them hammering and sawing in the backyard, and how I saw Judith once in a faded gingham sunbonnet to match the dress, giving them directions about making it. I remember how during all that slow and sunny afternoon they hammered and sawed right under the back parlor window. The slow, maddening rasp, rasp, rasp of the saw. The flat, deliberate hammer blows that seemed as though each would be the last, but was not. Repeated and resumed just when the dulled attenuation of the wearied nerves, stretched beyond all resiliency, relaxed to silence, and then had to scream again, until at last I went out there, and saw Judith in the barn lot in a cloud of chickens, her apron cradled about the gathered eggs, and asked them why there, why must it be just there? And they both stopped long and more than long enough for Jones to turn and spit again and say, because it wouldn't be so fur to tote the box, and how before my very back was turned he, one of them, added further, out of some amazed and fumbling ratiocination of inertia, how it would be simpler yit to fetch him down and nail the planks around him, only maybe Mrs. Judy wouldn't like it. I remember how as we carried him down the stairs and out to the waiting wagon, I tried to take the full weight of the coffin to prove to myself that he was really in it, and I could not tell. I was one of his pall-bearers, yet I could not, would not, believe something which I knew could not but be so. Because I never saw him, you see. There are some things which happen to us which the intelligence and the senses refuse, just as the stomach sometimes refuses what the palate has accepted, but which digestion cannot compass. Occurrences which stop us dead as though by some impalpable intervention, like a sheet of glass through which we watch all subsequent events transpire, as though in a soundless vacuum, and fade and vanish, are gone, leaving us immobile, impotent, helpless, fixed until we can die. That was I. I was there. Something of me walked in measured cadence with the measured tread of Jones and his companion, and Theophilus McCaslin, who had heard the news somehow back in town, and Clytie, as we bore the awkward and unmanageable box past the stairs close turning, while Judith, following, steadied it from behind, and so down and out to the wagon. Something of me helped to raise that which it could not have raised alone, yet which it still could not believe, into the waiting wagon. Something of me stood beside the gashy earth in the cedar's somber gloom, and heard the clumsy knell of clods upon the wood, and answered no when Judith at the grave's mounded end said, "He was a Catholic. Do any of you all know how Catholics?" And Theophilus McCaslin said, "Catholic be damned, he was a soldier, and I can pray for any Confederate soldier." And then cried in his old man's shrill, harsh, loud, cacophonous voice, "Yea, Forrest! Yea, John Sartorius! Yea!" And something walked with Judith and Clytie back across that sunset field and answered in some curious, serene suspension to the serene, quiet voice which talked of plowing corn and cutting winter wood. And in the lamplit kitchen helped this time to cook the meal, and helped to eat it too within the room beyond whose ceiling he no longer lay, and went to bed, yes, took a candle from that firm and trembling hand, and thought she did not even weep, and then in a lamp-gloomed mirror saw my own face and thought, nor did you either. Within that house where he had sojourned for another brief and this time final space, and left no trace of him, not even tears. Yes, one day he was not, then he was, then he was not. It was too short, too fast, too quick. 6 hours of a summer afternoon saw it all, a space too short to leave even the imprint of a body on a mattress, and blood can come from anywhere, if there was blood, since I never saw him. For all I was allowed to know, we had no corpse. We even had no murderer. We did not even speak of Henry that day, not one of us. I did not say, the aunt, the spinster, did he look well or ill? I did not say one of the thousand trivial things with which the indomitable woman blood ignores the man's world in which the blood kinsman shows the courage or cowardice, the folly or lust or fear for which his fellows praise or crucify him, who came and crashed a door and cried his crime and vanished, who, for the fact that he was still alive, was just that much more shadowy than the abstraction which we had nailed into a box. A shot heard only by its echo, a strange, gaunt, half-wild horse, bridled and with empty saddle, the saddle-bags containing a pistol, a worn clean shirt, a lump of iron like bread, captured by a man 4 miles away and 2 days later while trying to force the crib door in his stable. Yes, more than that. He was absent, and he was. He returned, and he was not. 3 women put something into the earth and covered it, and he had never been. Now you will ask me why I stayed there. I could say I do not know, could give 10,000 paltry reasons, all untrue, and be believed, that I stayed for food, who could have combed ditch banks and weed beds, made and worked a garden as well at my own home in town as here, not to speak of neighbors, friends whose alms I might have accepted, since necessity has a way of obliterating from our conduct various delicate scruples regarding honor and pride, that I stayed for shelter, who had a roof of my own in fee simple now indeed, or that I stayed for company, who at home could have had the company of neighbors who were at least of my own kind, who had known me all my life and even longer in the sense that they thought not only as I thought, but as my forebears thought, while here I had for company one woman whom, for all she was blood-kin to me, I did not understand, and if what my observation warranted me to believe was true, I did not wish to understand, and another who was so foreign to me and to all that I was, that we might have been not only of different races, which we were, not only of different sexes, which we were not, but of different species, speaking no language which the other understood, the very simple words with which we were forced to adjust our days to one another being even less inferential of thought or intention than the sounds which a beast and a bird might make to each other. But I don't say any of these. I stayed there and waited for Thomas Sutphen to come home. Yes, you will say or believe that I waited even then to become engaged to him. If I said I did not, you would believe I lied. But I do say I did not. I waited for him exactly as Judith and Clytie waited for him, because now he was all we had, all that gave us any reason for continuing to exist, to eat food and sleep and wake and rise again, knowing that he would need us, knowing as we did, who knew him, that he would begin at once to salvage what was left of Sutphen's hundred and restore it. Not that we would or did need him. I had never for one instant thought of marriage, never for one instant imagined that he would look at me, see me, since he never had. You may believe me, because I shall make no bones to say so when the moment comes to tell you when I did think of it. No, It did not even require the first day of the life we were to lead together to show us that we did not need him, had not the need for any man, so long as Wash Jones lived or stayed there. I, who had kept my father's house and he alive for almost 4 years, Judith, who had done the same out here, and Clatty, who could cut a cord of wood or run a furrow better, or at least quicker, than Jones himself. And this the sad fact, one of the saddest, that weary tedium which the heart and spirit feel when they no longer need that to whose need they, the spirit and the heart, are necessary. No, we did not need him, not even vicariously, who could not even join him in his furious, that almost mad intention which he brought home with him, seemed to project, radiate ahead of him before he even dismounted, desire to restore the place to what it had been, that he had sacrificed pity and gentleness and love and all the soft virtues for, if he had ever had them to sacrifice, felt their lack, desired them of others. Not even that. Neither Judith nor I wanted that. Perhaps it was because we did not believe it could be done, but I think it was more than that. That we now existed in an apathy which was almost peace, like that of the blind, unsentient earth itself which dreams after no flower's stalk nor bud, envies not the airy musical solitude of the spring and leaves it nourishes. So we waited for him. We led the busy, eventless lives of three nuns in a barren and poverty-stricken convent. The walls we had were safe, impervious enough, even if it did not matter to the walls whether we ate or not. And amicably, not as two white women and a negress, not as three negroes or three whites, not even as three women, but merely as three creatures who still possessed the need to eat but took no pleasure in it, the need to sleep but from no joy in weariness or regeneration, and in whom sex was some forgotten atrophy like the rudimentary gills we call the tonsils, or the still opposable thumbs for old climbing. We kept the house, what part of it we lived in, used. We kept the room which Thomas Sutpen would return to, not that one which he left, a husband, but the one to which he should return, a sonless widower, barren of that posterity which he doubtless must have wanted, who had gone to the trouble and expense of getting children and housing them among imported furniture beneath crystal chandeliers. Just as we kept Henry's room, as Judith and Clatty kept it, that is, as if he had not run up the stairs that summer afternoon and then run down again. We grew and tended and harvested with our own hands the food we ate, made and worked that garden just as we cooked and ate the food which came out of it. With no distinction among the three of us of age or color, but just as to who could build this fire, or stir this pot, or weed this bed, or carry this apron full of corn to the mill for meal with least cost to the general good in time or expense of other duties. It was as though we were one being, interchangeable and indiscriminate, which kept that garden growing, spun thread and wove the cloth we wore, hunted and found and rendered the meager ditch-side herbs to protect and guarantee what spot and compromise we dared or had the time to make with illness, harried and nagged that Jones into working the corn and cutting the wood which was to be our winter's warmth and sustenance. The three of us, three women, I drafted by circumstance at too soon an age into a pinch-penny housewifery which might have existed just as well upon a lighthouse rock, which had not even taught me how to cultivate a bed of flowers, let alone a kitchen garden, which had taught me to look upon fuel and meat as something appearing by its own volition in a wood-box or on a pantry shelf. Judith, created by circumstance, 100 years of careful nurturing, perhaps not by blood, not even Coldfield blood, but certainly by the tradition in which Thomas Sutpen's ruthless will had carved a niche, to pass through the soft, insulated, and unscathed cocoon stages. Bud, served prolific queen, then potent and soft-handed matriarch of old ages serene and well-lived content. Judith, handicapped by what in me was a few years' ignorance, but which in her was 10 generations of iron prohibition, who had not learned that first principle of penury which is to scrimp and save for the sake of scrimping and saving, who, and abetted by Clytie, would cook twice what we could eat and 3 times what we could afford and give it to anyone, any stranger in a land already beginning to fill with straggling soldiers who stopped and asked for it. And, but not least, Clytie. Clytie, not inept, anything but inept, perverse, inscrutable, and paradox, free yet incapable of freedom, who had never once called herself a slave, holding fidelity to none like the indolent and solitary wolf or bear, yes, wild, half-untamed black, half-Sutphen blood, and if untamed be synonymous with wild, then Sutphen is the silent, unsleeping viciousness of the tamer's lash, whose false seeming holds it docile to fear's hand, but which is not, which if this be fidelity, fidelity only to the prime fixed principle of its own savageness. Clytie, who in the very pigmentation of her flesh represented that debacle which had brought Judith and me to what we were, and which had made of her, Clytie, that which she declined to be, just as she had declined to be that from which its purpose had been to emancipate her. As though presiding aloof upon the new, she deliberately remained to represent to us the threatful portent of the old. We were three strangers. I do not know what Clytie thought, what life she led which the food we raised and cooked in unison, the cloth we spun and wove together, nourished and sheltered. But I expected that because she and I were open, I honorable, enemies. But I did not even know what Judith thought and felt. We slept in the same room, the three of us. This for more than to conserve the firewood which we had to carry in ourselves. We did it for safety. It was winter soon, and already soldiers were beginning to come back. The stragglers, not all of them tramps, ruffians, but men who had risked and lost everything, suffered beyond endurance and had returned now to a ruined land, not the same men who had marched away but transformed, and this the worst, the ultimate degradation to which war brings the spirit, the soul, into the likeness of that man who abuses from very despair and pity the beloved wife or mistress who in his absence has been raped. We were afraid. We fed them. We gave them what and all we had, and we would have assumed their wounds and left them whole again if we could, but we were afraid of them. We waked and fulfilled the endless, tedious obligations which the sheer holding to life and breath entailed. We would sit before the fire after supper, the three of us in that state where the very bones and muscles are too tired to rest, when the attenuated and invincible spirit has changed and shaped even hopelessness into the easy obliviousness of a worn garment. And talk of 100 things, the weary recurrent triviata of our daily lives, of 1,000 things, but not of one. We talked of him, Thomas Sutphen, of the end of the war. We could all see it now. And when he would return, of what he would do. How begin the Herculean task which we knew he would set himself, into which, oh yes, we knew this too, he would undoubtedly sweep us with the old ruthlessness whether we would or no. We talked of Henry, quietly, that normal, useless, impotent woman worrying about the absent male, as to how he fared, if he were cold or hungry or not, just as we talked of his father, as if both they and we still lived in that time which that shot, those running mad feet, had put a period to and then obliterated, as though that afternoon had never been. But not once did we mention Charles Bond. There were 2 afternoons in the late fall when Judith was absent, returning at supper time serene and calm. I did not ask, and I did not follow her. Yet I knew, and I knew that Clytie knew, that she had gone to clear that grave of dead leaves and the sere brown refuse of the cedars. That mound vanishing slowly back into the earth, beneath which we had buried nothing. No, there had been no shot. That sound was merely the sharp and final clap to of a door between us and all that was, all that might have been. A retroactive severance of the stream of event. A forever crystallized instant in imponderable time, accomplished by 3 weak yet indomitable women, which, preceding the accomplished fact which we declined, refused, robbed the brother of the prey, reft the murderer of a victim for his very bullet. That was how we lived for 7 months. And then one afternoon in January, Thomas Sutphen came home. Someone looked up from where we were preparing the garden for another year's food, and saw him riding up the drive. And then one evening I became engaged to marry him. It took me just 3 months. Do you mind how I don't say he, but I? Yes, I, just 3 months, who for 20 years had looked on him, when I did, had to, look, as an ogre, some beast out of a tale to frighten children with, who had seen his own get upon my dead sister's body already begin to destroy one another, yet who must come to him like a whistled dog at that first opportunity, that noon when he who had been seeing me for 20 years should first raise his head and pause and look at me. Oh, I hold no brief for myself who could, and would, I doubtless have already, give you 1,000 specious reasons good enough for women, ranging from woman's natural inconsistency to the desire or even hope for possible wealth, position, or even the fear of dying manless, which, so they will doubtless tell you, old maids always have, or for revenge. No, I hold no brief for me. I could have gone home, and I did not. Perhaps I should have gone home, but I did not. As Judith and Clatty did, I stood there before the rotting portico and watched him ride up on that gaunt and jaded horse on which he did not seem to sit, but rather seemed to project himself ahead like a mirage, in some fierce dynamic rigidity of impatience which the gaunt horse, the saddle, the boots, the leaf-colored and threadbare coat with its tarnished and flapping braid containing the sentient, though nerveless, shell, could not keep up with, which seemed to precede him as he dismounted, and out of which he said, "Well, daughter," and stooped and touched his beard to Judith's forehead, who had not, did not move, who stood rigid and still and immobile of face, and within which they spoke 4 sentences, 4 sentences of simple, direct words, behind, beneath, above which I felt that same rapport of communal blood which I had sensed that day while Clytie held me from the stairs. "Henry's not..." "No, he's not here." "Ah, and..." "Yes, Henry killed him," and then burst into tears. Yes, burst, who had not wept yet, who had brought down the stairs that afternoon and worn ever since that cold, calm face which had stopped me in mid-running at that closed door. Yes, burst, as if that entire accumulation of 7 months were erupting spontaneously from every pore in one incredible evacuation. She not moving a muscle, and then vanishing, disappearing, as instantaneously as if the very fierce and arid aura which he had enclosed her in were drying the tears faster than they emerged. And still standing with his hands on her shoulders and looked at Clytie and said, "Ah, Clytie," and then at me, the same face which I had last seen, only a little thinner, the same ruthless eyes, the hair grizzled a little now, and no recognition in the face at all until Judith said, "It's Rosa, Aunt Rosa. She lives here now." That was all. He rode up the drive and into our lives again and left no ripple save those instantaneous and incredible tears. Because he himself was not there, not in the house where we spent our days, had not stopped there. The shell of him was there, using the room which we had kept for him and eaten the food which we produced and prepared, as if it could neither feel the softness of the bed nor make distinction between the viands either as to quality or taste. Yes, he wasn't there. Something ate with us. We talked to it, and it answered questions. It sat with us before the fire at night, and rousing without any warning from some profound and bemused complete inertia, talked, not to us, the 6 ears, the 3 minds capable of listening, but to the air, the waiting grim decaying presence, spirit of the house itself. Talking that which sounded like the bombast of a madman who creates within his very coffin walls his fabulous immeasurable Camelots and Carcassons. Not absent from the place, the arbitrary square of earth which he had named Sutphen's Hundred, not that at all. He was absent only from the room, and that because he had to be elsewhere, a part of him encompassing each ruined field and fallen fence and crumbling wall of cabin or cotton house or crib. Himself diffused and in solution, held by that electric furious immobile urgency and awareness of short time and the need for haste, as if he had just drawn breath and looked about and realized that he was old, he was 59, and was concerned, not afraid, concerned, not that old age might have left him impotent to do what he intended to do, but that he might not have time to do it in before he would have to die. We were right about what he would intend to do, that he would not even pause for breath before undertaking to restore his house and plantation as near as possible to what it had been. We did not know how he would go about it, nor, I believe, did he. He could not have known, who came home with nothing, to nothing, to 4 years less than nothing. But it did not stop him, intimidate him. His was that cold, alert fury of the gambler who knows that he may lose anyway, but that with a second's flagon of the fierce constant will he is sure to, and who keeps suspense from ever quite crystallizing by sheer fierce manipulation of the cards or dice until the ducts and glands of luck begin to flow again. He did not pause, did not take that day or two to let the bones and flesh of 59 recuperate. The day or two in which he might have talked, not about us and what we had been doing, but about himself, the past 4 years. For all he ever told us, there might not have been any war at all. Or it on another planet, and no stake of his risked on it, no flesh and blood of his to suffer by it. That natural period, during which bitter though unmaimed defeat might have exhausted itself to something like peace, like quiet in the raging and incredulous recountin', which enables man to bear with livin', of that feather's balance between victory and disaster, which makes that defeat unbearable which, turning against him, yet declined to slay him who, still alive, yet cannot bear to live with it. We hardly ever saw him. He would be gone from dawn until dark, he and Jones and another man or two that he had got from somewhere and paid with something, perhaps the same coin in which he had paid that foreign architect, cajolery, promise, threat, and at last force. That was the winter when we began to learn what carpetbagger meant, and people, women, locked doors and windows at night and began to frighten each other with tales of Negro uprisings, when the ruined, the 4 years' fallow and neglected land lay more idle yet while men with pistols in their pockets gathered daily at secret meeting places in the towns. He did not make one of these. I remember how one night a deputation called, rode out through the mud of early March, and put him to the point of definite yes or no, with them or against them, friend or enemy. And he refused, declined, offered them, with no change of gaunt, ruthless face nor level voice, defiance, if it was defiance they wanted, telling them that if every man in the South would do as he himself was doing, would see to the restoration of his own land, the general land and South would save itself, and ushered them from the room and from the house, and stood plain in the doorway holding the lamp above his head while their spokesman delivered his ultimatum. "This may be war, Sutphen," and answered, "I am used to it." Oh, yes, I watched him, watched his old man's solitary fury fight now, not with the stubborn yet slowly tractable earth, as it had done before, but now against the ponderable weight of the changed new time itself, as though he were trying to dam a river with his bare hands and a shingle. And this for the same spurious delusion of reward which had failed, failed, betrayed, and would this time destroy, him once. I see the analogy myself now. The accelerating circle's fatal curve and course of his ruthless pride, his lust for vain magnificence, though I did not then. And how could I? Turned 20, true enough, yet still a child, still living in that womb-like corridor where the world came not even as living echo but as dead incomprehensible shadow, where with the quiet and unalarmed amazement of a child I watched the miragey antics of men and women. My father, my sister, Thomas Sutphen, Judith, Henry, Charles Bond, called honor, principle, marriage, love, bereavement, death. The child who, watching him, was not a child, but one of that triumvirate mother-woman which we three, Judith, Clytie, and I, made, which fed and clothed and warmed the static shell and so gave vent and scope to the fierce vain illusion, and so said, "At last my life is worth something, even though it only shields and guards the antic fury of an insane child." And then one afternoon I was in the garden with a hoe where the path came up from the stable lot. I looked up and saw him looking at me. He had seen me for 20 years, but now he was looking at me. He stood there in the path looking at me in the middle of the afternoon. That was it. That it should have been in the middle of the afternoon, when he should not have been anywhere near the house at all, but miles away and invisible somewhere among his 100 square miles which they had not troubled to begin to take away from him yet. Perhaps not even at this point or at that point, but diffused. Not attenuated to thinness, but enlarged, magnified, encompassing as though in a prolonged and unbroken instant of tremendous effort, embracing and holding intact that 10-mile square, while he faced from the brink of disaster, invincible and unafraid, what he must have known would be the final defeat. But instead of that, standing there in the path, looking at me with something curious and strange in his face, as if the barn lot, the path at the instant when he came in sight of me, had been a swamp out of which he had emerged without having been forewarned that he was about to enter light, and then went on. The face, the same face. It was not love. I do not say that, not gentleness or pity. Just a sudden overburst of light, illumination, who had been told that his son had done murder and vanished and said, "Ah, well, Clytie." He went on to the house. But it was not love. I do not claim that. I hold no brief for myself. I do not excuse it. I could have said that he had needed, used me. Why should I rebel now because he would use me more? But I did not say it. I could say this time I do not know, and I would tell the truth. Because I do not know. He was gone. I did not even know that either, since there is a metabolism of the spirit as well as of the entrails, in which the stored accumulations of long time burn, generate, create, and break some maidenhead of the ravening meat. I, in a second's time, yes, lost all the shibboleth eruptin' of cannot, will not, never will, in one red instant's fierce obliteration. This was my instant, who could have fled then and did not, who found that he had gone on and did not remember when he had walked away, who found my okra bed finished without remembering the completing of it, who sat at the supper table that night with the familiar dream cloudy shell which we had grown used to. He did not look at me again during the meal. I might have said then, to what deluded sewer gush of dreamin' does the incorrigible flesh betray us, but I did not. And then before the fire in Judith's bedroom sat as we always did until he came in the door and looked at us and said, "Judith, you and Clytie," and ceased, still entering, then said, "No, never mind. Rosa will not mind if you both hear too, since we are short for time and busy with what we have of it," and came and stopped and put his hand on my head and— I do not know what he looked at while he spoke, save that by the sound of his voice it was not at us nor at anything in that room. Said, "You may think I made your sister Ellen no very good husband. You probably do think so. But even if you will not discount the fact that I am older now, I believe I can promise that I shall do no worse, at least, for you." That was my courtship. That minute's exchanged look in a kitchen garden, that hand upon my head in his daughter's bedroom. A ukase, a decree, a serene and florid boast like a sentence, I and delivered in the same attitude, not to be spoken and heard, but to be read carved in the bland stone which pediments a forgotten and nameless effigy. I do not excuse it. I claim no brief, no pity, who did not answer, "I will," not because I was not asked, because there was no place, no niche, no interval for reply. Because I could have made one, I could have forced that niche myself if I had willed to, a niche not shaped to fit mild, yes, but some blind, desperate female weapon's frenzied slash whose very gaping wound had cried, "No, no," and "Help and save me." No, no brief, no pity. Who did not even move, who sat beneath that hard, oblivious childhood ogre's hand and heard him speak to Judith now, heard Judith's feet, saw Judith's hand, not Judith. That palm in which I read as from a printed chronicle the orphanin, the hardship, the bereave of love. The 4 hard barren years of scoriatin' loom, of axe and hoe and all the other tools decreed for men to use. And upon it lying the ring which he gave Ellen in the church almost 30 years ago. Yes, analogy and paradox and madness too. I sat there and felt, not watched him slip the ring onto my finger in my turn. He was sitting now also in the chair which we called Clytie's, while she stood just beyond the firelight's range beside the chimney, and listened to his voice as Ellen must have listened in her own spirit's April 30 years ago. He talking not about me, or love, or marriage, not even about himself, and to no sane mortal listening, nor out of any sanity, but to the very dark forces of fate which he had evoked and dared, out of that wild braggart dream, where an intact Sutphen's Hundred which no more had actual being now, and would never have again, than it had when Ellen first heard it, as though in the restoration of that ring to a living finger he had turned all time back 20 years and stopped it, froze it. Yes, I sat there and listened to his voice and told myself, why, he is mad. He will decree this marriage for tonight and perform his own ceremony, himself both groom and minister. Pronounce his own wild benediction on it with the very bedwood candle in his hand. And I'm mad, too, for I will acquiesce, succumb, abet him, and plunge down. No, I hold no brief, ask no pity. If I was saved that night, and I was saved, mine was to be some later, colder sacrifice when I should be free of all excuse of the surprised, importunate, traitorous flesh. It was no fault, no doing of my own, but rather because, once he had restored the ring, he ceased to look at me save as he had looked for the 20 years before that afternoon, as if he had reached for the moment some interval of sanity such as the mad know, just as the sane have intervals of madness to keep them aware that they are sane. It was more than that, even. For 3 months now he had seen me daily, though he had not looked at me since I merely made one of that triumvirate who received his gruff, unspoken man's gratitude for the Spartan ease we supplied. Not to his comfort, perhaps, but at least to the mad dream he lived in. But for the next 2 months he did not even see me. Perhaps the reason was the obvious one. He was too busy. But having accomplished his engagement, granted that was what he wanted, he did not need to see me. Certainly he did not. There was not even any date set for the wedding. It was almost as though that very afternoon did not exist, had never happened. I might not have even been there in the house. Worse, I could have gone, returned home, and he would not have missed me. I was, whatever it was he wanted of me, not my being, my presence, just my existence, whatever it was that Rosa Coldfield or any young female no blood kin to him represented in whatever it was he wanted. Because I will do him this credit. He had never once thought about what he asked me to do until the moment he asked it, because I know that he would not have waited 2 months or even 2 days to ask it. My presence was to him only the absence of black morass and snarled vine and creeper to that man who had struggled through a swamp with nothing to guide or drive him. No hope, no light, only some incorrigibility of undefeat, and blundered at last and without warning onto dry solid ground and sun and air. If there could have been such thing as sun to him, if anyone or anything could have competed with the white glare of his madness. Yes, mad, yet not so mad, because there is a practicality to viciousness. The thief, the liar, the murderer even has faster rules than virtue ever has. Why not madness too? If he was mad, it was only his compelling dream which was insane and not his methods. It was no madman who bargained and cajoled hard manual labor out of men like Jones. It was no madman who kept clear of the sheets and hoods and night-galloping horses, with which men who were once his acquaintances, even if not his friends, discharged the canker suppuration of defeat. It was no madman's plan or tactics which gained him at the lowest possible price the sole woman available to wive him, and by the one device which could have gained his point. Not madman, no. Since surely there is something in madness, even the demoniac, which Satan flees, aghast at his own handiwork, and which God looks on in pity. Some spark, some crumb to leaven and redeem that articulated flesh, that speech, sight, hear and taste and being which we call human man. But no matter. I will tell you what he did and let you be the judge, or try to tell you, because there are some things for which 3 words are 3 too many, and 3,000 words that many words too less, and this is one of them. It can be told. I could take that many sentences, repeat the bold, blank, naked, and outrageous words just as he spoke them, and bequeath you only that same aghast and outraged unbelief I knew when I comprehended what he meant, or take 3,000 sentences and leave you only that why, and why that I have asked and listened to for almost 50 years. But I will let you be the judge and let you tell me if I was not right. You see, I was that son, or thought I was, who did believe there was that spark, that crumb in madness which is divine, though madness know no word itself for terror or for pity. There was an ogre of my childhood which, before my birth, removed my only sister to its grim ogre-born, and produced two half-phantom children whom I was not encouraged and did not desire to associate with, as if my late-born solitude had taught me presentiment of that fateful intertwining, warned me of that fatal snarly climax before I knew the name for murder. And I forgave it. There was a shape which rode away beneath a flag, and, demon or no, courageously suffered. And I did more than just forgive. I slew it. Because the body, the blood, the memory which that ogre had dwelt in returned 5 years later and held out its hand and said, "Come," as you might say it to a dog, and I came. Yes, the body, the face, with the right name and memory, even the correct remembrance of what and whom, except myself, and was that not but further proof, it had left behind and returned to. But not the ogre, villain true enough, but a mortal, fallible one, less to invoke fear than pity. But no ogre, mad true enough, but I told myself, why should not madness be its own victim also? Or, why may it be not even madness, but solitary despair in titan conflict with the lonely and foredoomed and indomitable iron spirit? But no ogre, because it was dead, vanished, consumed somewhere in flame and sulphur reek, perhaps, among the lonely craggy peaks of my childhood's solitary remembering, or forgetting. I was that son, who believed that he, after that evening in Judith's room, was not oblivious of me, but only unconscious and receptive, like the swamp-freed pilgrim feeling earth and tasting sun and light again, and aware of neither, but only of darknesses and morasses' lack. Who did believe that there was that magic in unkin blood which we call by the pallid name of love that could be, might be, son for him, though I the youngest, weakest, where Judith and Clytie both would cast no shadow? Yes, I the youngest there, yet potently without measured and measurable age, since I alone of them could say, O furious mad old man, I hold no substance that will fit your dream, but I can give you airy space and scope for your delirium. And then one afternoon, oh, there was a fate in it, afternoon and afternoon and afternoon, do you see? The death of hope and love, the death of pride and principle, and then the death of everything save the old outraged and aghast unbelieving which has lasted for 43 years. He returned to the house and called me, shouting from the back gallery until I came down. Oh, I told you he had not thought of it until that moment, that prolonged moment which contained the distance between the house and wherever it was he had been standing when he thought of it. And this, too, coincident. It was the very day on which he knew definitely and at last exactly how much of his 100 square miles he would be able to save and keep and call his own, on the day when he would have to die, that no matter what happened to him now, he would at least retain the shell of Sutpen's 100, even though a better name for it would now be Sutpen's 1. Called, shouted for me until I came down. He had not even waited to tether his horse. He stood with the reins over his arm, and no hand on my head now, and spoke the bald, outrageous words exactly as if he were consulting with Jones or with some other man about a bitch dog or a cow or mare. They will have told you how I came back home. Oh, yes, I know. Rosie Coldfield, lose him, weep him, caught a man but couldn't keep him. Oh, yes, I know, and kind, too, they would be kind. Rosa Coldfield, warped, bitter, orphaned country stick called Rosa Coldfield, safely engaged at last, and so off the town, the county. They will have told you how I went out there to live for the rest of my life, seeing in my nephew's murdering an act of God enabling me ostensibly to obey my dying sister's request, that I save at least one of the two children which she had doomed by conceiving them, but actually to be in the house when he returned, who, being a demon, would therefore be impervious to shot and shell, and so would return. I waited for him because I was young still, who had buried no hopes to bugles beneath a flag, and ripe for marrying in this time and place where most of the young men were dead, and all the living ones either old or already married or tired, too tired for love. He my best, my only chance in this. An environment where at best and even lacking war my chances would have been slender enough, since I was not only a southern gentlewoman, but the very modest character of whose background and circumstances must needs be their own affirmation, since had I been the daughter of a wealthy planter, I could have married almost anyone. But being the daughter merely of a small storekeeper, I could even afford to accept flowers from almost no one, and so would have been doomed to marry at last some casual apprentice clerk in my father's business. Yes, they will have told you, who was young and had buried hopes only during that night which was 4 years long, when beside a shuttered and unsleeping candle she embalmed the war and its heritage of suffering and injustice and sorrow on the backsides of the pages within an old account book, embalming, blotting from the breathable air the poisonous secret effluvium of lusting and hating and killing. They will have told you, daughter of an ambuscé who had to turn to a demon, a villain, and therefore she had been right in hating her father, since if he had not died in that attic, she would not have had to go out there to find food and protection and shelter, and if she had not had to depend on his food and clothing, even if she did help to grow and weave it, to keep her alive and warm until simple justice demanded that she make what return for it he might require of her commensurate with honor, she would not have become engaged to him. And if she had not become engaged to him, she would not have had to lie at night asking herself why and why and why, as she has done for 43 years, as if she had been instinctively right even as a child in hating her father. And so these 43 years of impotent and unbearable outrage were the revenge of some sophisticated and ironic sterile nature on her, for having hated that which gave her life. Yes, Rosa Coldfield, engaged at last, who, lacking the fact that her sister had bequeathed her at least something of shelter and kin, might have become a charge upon the town. And now Rosie Coldfield, lose him, weep him, found a man but failed to keep him. Rosa Coldfield, who would be right, only right, being right, is not enough for women who would rather be wrong than just that who want the man who was wrong to admit it. And that's what she can't forgive him for, not for the insult, not even for having jilted her, but for being dead. Oh, yes, I know, I know. How 2 months later they learned that she had packed up her belongings, that is, put on the shawl and hat again, and come back to town, to live alone in the house where her parents were dead and gone, and where Judith would come now and then and bring her some of what food they had out at Sutpen's Hundred, and which only dire necessity, the brute inexplicable flesh's stubborn will to live, brought her, Miss Coldfield, to accept. And it dire indeed, because now the town, farmers passing, negro servants going to work in white kitchens, would see her before sunup gathering greens along garden fences, pulling them through the fence, since she had no garden of her own, no seed to plant one with, no tools to work it with herself, even if she had known completely how, who had had only the freshman year at gardening and doubtless would not have worked it if she had known, who had never surrendered, reaching through the garden fence and gathering vegetables, who would have been welcome to enter the garden and get them, and they would have even done the gathering and sent them to her, since there were more people than Judge Benbow who would leave baskets of provisions on her front porch at night. But she would not permit them, who would not even use a stick to reach through the fence and draw the vegetables to where she could grasp them, the reach of her unaided arm being the limit of brigandage, which she never passed. And it not to keep from being seen stealing, which sent her forth before the town was awake, because if she had had a nigger she would have sent him forth in broad daylight to forage, where she would not have cared, exactly as the cavalry heroes whom she wrote verse about would have sent their men. Yes, Rosie Coldfield, lose him, weep him, caught a beau but couldn't keep him. Oh, yes, they will tell you, found a beau and was insulted, something heard and not forgiven. Not so much for the saying of it, but for having thought about her so that when she heard it she realized like a thunderclap that it must have been in his mind for a day, a week, even a month maybe. He looking at her daily with that in his mind and she not even knowing it. But I forgave him. They will tell you different, but I did. Why shouldn't I? I had nothing to forgive. I had not lost him because I never owned him. A certain segment of rotten mud walked into my life, spoke that to me which I had never heard before and never shall again, and then walked out. That was all. I never owned him, certainly not in that sewer sense, which you would mean by that and maybe think, but you are wrong, I mean. That did not matter. That was not even the nub of the insult. I mean that he was not owned by anyone or anything in this world, had never been, would never be, not even by Ellen, not even by Jones's granddaughter. Because he was not articulated in this world. He was a walking shadow. He was the light-blinded, bat-like image of his own torment cast by the fierce demoniac lantern up from beneath the earth's crust, and hence in retrograde, reverse, from abysmal and chaotic dark to eternal and abysmal dark, complete in his descendant, do you mark the gradation? Ellipsis. Clinging, trying to cling with vain, unsubstantial hands to what he hoped would hold him, save him, arrest him. Ellen, do you mark them? Myself? Then last of all, that fatherless daughter of Wash Jones's only child, who, so I heard once, died in a Memphis brothel. To find severance, even if not rest and peace, at last in the stroke of a rusty scythe. I was told, informed of that, too, though not by Jones this time, but by someone else kind enough to turn aside and tell me he was dead. Dead, I cried. Dead! You! You lie! You're not dead! Heaven cannot and hell dare not have you! But Quentin was not listening, because there was also something which he too could not pass. That door, the running feet on the stairs beyond it almost a continuation of the faint shot, the two women, the negress and the white girl in her underthings, made of flower sacking when there had been flour, of window curtains when not, pausing, looking at the door, the yellowed creamy mass of old intricate satin and lace spread carefully on the bed, and then caught swiftly up by the white girl and held before her as the door crashed in, and the brother stood there, hatless, with his shaggy bayonet-trimmed hair, his gaunt, worn, unshaven face, his patched and faded gray tunic, the pistol still hanging against his flank. The two of them, brother and sister, curiously alike, as if the difference in sex had merely sharpened the common blood to a terrific, an almost unbearable similarity, speaking to one another in short, brief, staccato sentences like slaps, as if they stood breast to breast, striking one another in turn, neither making any attempt to guard against the blows. Now you can't marry him. Why can't I marry him? Because he's dead. Dead? Yes, I killed him. He, Quentin, couldn't pass that. He was not even listening to her. He said, "Ma'am, what's that? What did you say?" "There's something in that house." "In that house? It's Clytie, don't she?" "No. Something living in it, hidden in it. It has been out there for 4 years, living hidden in that house."